Well, good morning, TNC family, on this third Sunday in February, where today, here, I want to talk with you about how to know a person. Because it's hard to love somebody if you don't know them. And our deepest call as followers of Jesus is to love one another. Mark chapter 12, Matthew 22, Jesus says, all the law and the prophets hang on this command. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Love. And it's very hard to love a person well if you don't know them. Now, of course, you can be loving toward them. You can do loving things, demonstrate loving behavior, but it's hard to actually love them. And this is true generally of pretty much anything. For example, I love the Atlanta United, although I could not tell you what their logo is or the team colors or the names of any of their players on the roster or any coaches or owners, and I've never watched a match or been to the pitch. I couldn't even tell you how wide the court is they play on or how high the net is or where the three-point line begins. But I love them. And you're like, that's baloney, David, because you don't know anything about it. You can't love what you don't know. This is why I can't say I love the poetry of Emily Dickinson. If you've never read anything she's written, and you don't know anything about her, and you don't know anybody who's been influenced by her poems. I love you, but I don't know anything about you, just doesn't work. And when it comes to human beings, it's exactly the same. It's very hard to love if you don't know a person. Now, again, I want to make that same clarification, which is you can still demonstrate love towards somebody, even strangers or causes, when you treat them with dignity and respect and kindness and charity, when you choose generosity and humility over selfishness and arrogance. But I'm not talking about that kind of love today. I'm talking about what David Brooks is talking about in his brand new book called How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen. In fact, most of anything good I say today, just so you know, I owe to his thinking and writing in his 2023 publication. Brooks is the best-selling author of many books, including two of my favorites, The Road to Character and The Second Mountain. He's one of our nation's leading writers and commentators. I've discovered he's a man of deep faith. And the premise of this book, How to Know a Person, is that there is one skill that lies at the heart of any healthy person, family, school, community, organization, or society, and that's the ability to see someone else deeply and to make that person feel seen. To accurately know another person, to let them feel valued, heard, understood. Which is not an easy task. In fact, it's almost always challenging and time-consuming. Because every person is so unique and at the same level mysterious. So it's going to be hard. It's going to take time. In the book, he tells the story of how in 1951, there was an especially violent football game between Dartmouth and Princeton. Afterwards, fans of both teams were furious because they felt that the opposing team had been just absolutely savage on the field, which caught the attention of psychologists on the campuses, who then had the students come in and rewatch the film of the game, but in a calmer setting, to challenge their in-the-moment biases. But when they were challenged about their biases after the game in a calmer setting in the film room, both sides still pointed out that this was now objective proof that they were right, that it was unfair, which caused the psychologist researching this phenomenon to say, quote, the data here indicate that there is no such thing as a game existing out there in its own, which people merely observe. Rather, the game exists for a person and is experienced by that person only insofar as certain things have significance in terms of his or her predetermined disposition. Because the students from the different schools constructed two different games depending on what they wanted to see, and Brooks goes on to say that this is true about almost everything This is how we see politics, how we see justice, how we see danger, how we see love. This is why an extrovert walks into a party and sees an entirely different room than an introvert sees. This is why a person who's been trained as an interior designer sees a different room than someone who's been trained as a security specialist. This is why, if I'm going to get to know you, it will not be because I have some magical ability to peer inside your soul. Rather, it will be because I've learned some small, concrete social actions well. Things like how to disagree without poisoning the relationship, how to be vulnerable at an appropriate pace, how to be a good listener, how to end a conversation gracefully, how to ask for and offer forgiveness, knowing how to let someone down without breaking their heart, how to sit with someone who's suffering, and on, which leads me now here to this. I just want to mention three skills that Brooks mentions in the book. He mentions more, but I just want to mention three here. Concrete actions, practices for how to come to know a person, to see them deeply and be deeply seen, because as we learn to embrace these, then we can begin to love. So, here's number one, first skill or practice for how to know a person. Number one, ask better questions. Ask better questions, because the best questions demonstrate humility, honor, interest, care, love. They convey, hey, I really do care and want to learn about you. The best questions actually are also the simplest ones. Why? Then what? How? What do you think? The best questions, TNC, are, to borrow the wisdom of Elizabeth Gilbert in her great book, Big Magic, the best questions are simply the curious ones. Just follow the clues, she says. Reminds me of a conversation I'll never forget from a long time ago at a Starbucks right by our church. I was reading a book one day, sitting in one of those big, comfy chairs, and a man came in, ordered a coffee, sat down next to me. And we started talking, and he said he was retired, but had worked at, I think it was Cox Communications, for like 35 years. And in that moment, I just got curious. Wow, 35 years. How long ago did you retire? He said, 1 year ago this month. And how has the last year gone in retirement? Fast, slow, in between? He said, fast, actually, faster than I imagined it would on the day I retired. I said, oh, what was that day like, the day you retired? Did you, like, have a milk crate and you took stuff out in, like a coffee mug, some pictures of family and friends, maybe a bobblehead, an award you won, a lanyard with an ID badge? Yeah, I did, he said. And I think maybe at first he thought I was being nosy, but after a few questions, I could tell he was so engaged and he felt seen by me. And I remember thinking, this is more than just an information exchange. It's common humanity and respect and value and being seen and known. And TNC, it wasn't like the perfect conversation. I never saw him again, but I do think it gets at the value of questions. Brooks goes on to talk about three bad categories of questions. First, he says, are interrogative. Where did you go to college? Hey, what neighborhood do you live in? What do you do for a living? They imply, he says, I'm about to judge you. Give the right answer. Second kind of bad questions, he says, are closed questions, where you come up with two options embedded in your question. Like, so, were you close to your mom growing up? In which you've limited your description to that person's relationship with their mom to either close or distant. It's better to ask, he said, how's your mom? Tell me about your relationship with her. Third set of bad questions, he says, are vague questions. Hey, how's it going? What's up? Questions impossible to answer, he says. They're another way of saying, I'm greeting you, but I don't actually want you to answer. Better questions are, how did you? What's it like to? Tell me about. And in what ways? And then later, he says, just get curious. What's working well in your life? Hey, if we were to meet a year from now and were to celebrate something about your life in the last year, what would we be celebrating? Better questions TNC will lead to better knowing, and love requires knowing. And so the first skill or practice for how to know a person is ask better questions. Which leads to number two, if you want to see others more deeply, the second skill or practice for how to know a person, number two, bring a better energy into the room. The title of chapter 13 in Brooks's book is actually, quote, "What energy do you bring into the room? Do you walk into rooms with agreeableness and openness and optimism and interest, or do you walk into rooms with heaviness and negativity, judgmentalness, a chip on your shoulder?" In the book, Brooks tells the story about a time when he was meeting with a woman named Mrs. Dorsey. She was 93 years old and had spent her career mostly as a teacher and a community activist. He writes, "That morning over breakfast, she presented herself to me as a stern drill sergeant type of woman who wanted me to know she was tough, who had standards, and who laid down the law. I loved my students enough to discipline them," she told me. And the conversation, he writes, remained cordial but cold. "I was a bit intimidated by her, actually," he writes, "until a mutual friend, Jimmy Durrell, entered the room and came to the table. Jimmy is a teddy bearish man in his 60s who had built a church for homeless people under a highway overpass, who now leads the homeless shelter by his house, and who worked with Mrs. Dorsey in various community projects over the years. He came across the room, came over to our table, smiling as broadly as it's possible for a human face to smile. Then he grabbed Mrs. Dorsey by the shoulders and shook her way harder than you would ever shake a 93-year-old. He leaned in inches from her face and cried out in a voice that filled the whole place, 'Mrs. Dorsey, Mrs. Dorsey, you are the best. You are the best. I love you. I love you.' And I've never seen a person's whole aspect transform so suddenly. The old, stern, disciplinarian face that she put on under my gaze vanished, and a joyous, delighted 9-year-old girl appeared. And in that moment, I began to fully appreciate the power of one's tone and energy." TNC, what energy do you bring into a room? And further, when you talk, is your tone filled with anger and accusation, or with gentleness and humility? I think of that great proverb, chapter 15, verse 1. "A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger." An observation that you can bring a different energy, dialogue, calmness, mood to every conversation and room you enter into. You can open doors or close them. Help people feel known and loved and safe and celebrated and heard. Or unknown and judged and unsafe and unheard. What energy do you bring into the room? Because a second skill or practice for how to know a person is to create an atmosphere and energy that leads to being known. Which leads to number three, if you want to see others more deeply, which is a prerequisite for love, number three, cultivate the art of empathy. Brooks writes about how it is a known chemical, biological, existential crisis when someone goes unseen and unknown for too long. And so we must learn to see others and see not just them, but see how they see. Cultivate the art of empathy, he writes. Or in the words of Adam Grant, the psychologist, best-selling author, and Wharton Business School professor, begin to truly see what he calls degrees of difficulty. Let me explain. In an interview, Grant was talking about learning to empathize with others, and he used an example from his own years in high school when he was named an All-American athlete in diving. You know, jumping off those high platforms, doing twists and rolls, and then entering a pool of water completely perpendicular to the water, almost no splash. We're going to see more of this soon, actually, this summer in Paris at the 33rd Olympiad. But in this interview, Grant makes the point that diving has introduced a phrase into our culture, degrees of difficulty, because it's not just how high the diving board is that you leapt from or how many twists you did in the air, it's the degree of difficulty involved in those things. And so there's a formula for your Olympic diving score. And so, for example, if you do a front 4.5, it's a 3.8 degree of difficulty on a 3-meter platform. But if you do an inward 3.5, it's only a 3.4 degree of difficulty. And the point is that the dive must be viewed in relationship to the degree of difficulty. The degree of difficulty must be factored in. And now I'm quoting Grant from the interview. Diving has taught me that you can't just judge an outcome all by itself. You have to judge the obstacles that the person pursuing those goals had to go through. It reminds me of when I served a 5-year term on the school council at the public elementary school near our church, a Title I school, which means it has a significant portion of students who, on the home front, deal with poverty, which also often meant coming home to empty houses because both parents were at work, which also often meant a lack of technology in the home, computers and other learning aids, which also meant in this case that a large percentage of the classroom had students for whom English was not their first language. And I sat on the school council and I listened to principals and teachers and reviewed test scores. And I remember thinking, nobody gives these teachers the credit they deserve for the degree of difficulty involved in what they do. Because if a classroom at this school has a collective 50th percentile on standardized tests, that might be a greater accomplishment than the school in the suburbs whose classrooms have a collective 90th percentile once you factor in degree of difficulty. Every situation has degrees of difficulty, and we need to learn to see that in every encounter, every encounter. And if you haven't attempted to figure out the degree of difficulty, then maybe don't even begin the dialogue yet, or don't begin it so bitterly or so angrily. Because if you start to factor in degree of difficulty, it can lead to empathy, which is a key to being known and therefore loved. So, TNC, our deepest call as followers of Jesus is to love one another. All the law and the prophets hang on this command, Jesus says. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Love, and it's very hard to love a person well if you don't know them. So, let's A, ask good questions, B, bring good energy, and C, cultivate the art of empathy, and together we can grow in this highest calling to love. Let's pray. God, I pray for every person listening right now. I pray, first of all, that they would understand and feel that they are known deeply by you, their creator, and you love them just the way they are. And you want to come alongside them and give them wisdom and strength and courage for the obstacles they face, for the places they're headed in life. And then, God, I pray, too, that our church would be this kind of environment. And now, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, turn his face toward you, and give you peace. Amen.